This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 15th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. Today it's going to be me, David Pleasant, bringing you the show, standing in for our regular host, Tom Morris. On the show today, we go to Hong Kong to hear from the city's annual Business of Design Week.
The biggest challenge for designers in Hong Kong is still having a space or having a platform to showcase their work and grow their career and brand.
Then we go to Milan to see some rather charming wooden toys just in time for Christmas.
We work with different kinds of woods, combining them in order to create a small object but with very nice details.
Plus, we'll pop into one very unique design studio in Moscow.
For me, inspiration is easy thing because every day I met some new people and lots of them trying to change the world around them.
That's all here on Section D with me, David Pleasant, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D with me, David Pleasant. To kick off the show, we go to Hong Kong. Started in 2002, Business of Design Week is an annual week-long program bringing together the city's finest design and creative minds with designers and guests from a partner country. In its 10th year, as a sister event to Business of Design Week, Detour has grown into a week-long series of events and programmes featuring Hong Kong's young and upcoming creative talent. Held this year at PMQ, the city's former police married quarters, that has been revitalised as a hub for design and arts enterprises, with a selection of exhibitions and pop-up stands. William Toh, creative director of PMQ and curator of this year's Detour, spoke to Monocle's Vivian Liu about this year's programme.
Detour is a concurrent event of the Business of Design Week, and it brings design into the city, celebrating design and showcasing young design talent locally and internationally. So it's a very different and dynamic program in different formats. It's a much freer program. It can be in any kind of format and any kind of expression. So it's more dynamic and fun.
This year marks the 10th year of Detour. Have you done any special events, or has the program changed over the years?
Actually, the program has been evolving every once in a while. When I first took over BODW in 2005, Detour at that time was just, what we did was just printed a little map to bring people to walk around the city and look at the different design and design culture, local design culture. And after that, when the program was passed to the Hong Kong Ambassador of Design, they grew it into a much bigger scale and bringing in a lot of different content. That happens, but one of their difficulties in the past 4 or 5 years was to find a site every year for them to curate their program. And now that PMQ has a permanent site and the Hong Kong Ambassador of Design has decided to change the role to establishing design trust, then it's most natural and it makes most sense to pass the Detour program back to PMQ, and I'm really delighted to be running it again.
You're also the creative director of PMQ, and for those unfamiliar with the PMQ, it's a creative hub dedicated to promoting Hong Kong designers, Hong Kong creative talent. How do you think PMQ has changed the design scene in Hong Kong?
Well, we've only opened since April, so we haven't changed much yet. But I think we did provide a new creative platform for our young design entrepreneurs to showcase their work and to connect them to the market and to the consumer. This is our first step. And as we grow, I'd like to see ourselves fine-tuning the site and fine-tuning the program and started getting involved in more creative education programs to nurture a much more creative younger generation.
What challenges do you think the Hong Kong creative scene or Hong Kong design scene specifically faces?
Well, one of the biggest difficulties they have is having a space to showcase their work. And with PMQ's opening, the situation has improved, but PMQ is only so big. So the opportunities is still very limited. So I think the biggest challenge for designers in Hong Kong is still having a space or having a platform to showcase their work and grow their career and brand.
And as a visitor to Detour or PMQ, what kind of creative elements can we expect to see or would we be able to visit?
We have different elements. We have installations by local artists, PMQ tenants, and also overseas artists. We have workshops every day. We have design dialogues every evening. And we have petriculture. We have pop shops from bringing in a lot of creative young talents and brands that have never been showcased in Hong Kong from Sweden. So it's a very dynamic program. And on weekends, we have the Creative Mart and we have evening programs and workshops for kids.
And Detour is something that happens annually. Over the course of 2015, are there any exciting developments for PMQ that you can share with us?
Well, although we have been open for 7 months now, but there are some elements inside PMQ still hasn't been ready. It's not quite ready yet, and we will eventually launch them. One of them is the Taste Library, which will be open to the public. And then we will have one whole complete floor of share office, we call the Hub, that will be open to the public and the design community as well. And we will also have our own design shop called Design PMQ. That will be another platform to showcase products and designers from overseas who've never been in this part of the world and who wants to test out their market. So these are the new elements that will soon be coming to PMQ.
And with regards to Detour, what changes can we expect?
Well, this is the first year we run Detour, PMQ hosts Detour. So next year, what I'd like to do is to extend the program into our neighborhood, engaging our community and all the neighborhood establishment to join force, co-create a program that involves the celebration of design excellence.
That was Monocle's Vivian Liu speaking to William Toh, creative director of PMQ and curator of this year's Detour, the sister festival of the Business of Design Week in Hong Kong. London's famed Victoria and Albert Museum has massive expansion projects underway that will see the launch of a new branch in London's former Olympic Park and also entry into China. 2018 will mark the unveiling of the V&A's new space in East London, while in Asia, the V&A will also develop the Sheku Design Museum in Shenzhen, set to open in 2016. Whilst visiting Hong Kong, director Martin Roth and Louisa Mengoni, head of V&A Sheku, met with Monocle's Vivian Liu for a chat about upcoming developments.
It's extremely important in order to keep the V&A also in the future. The mothership of the V&A needs more space, needs different space, needs somehow an architectural development that will reveal parts of the museum to bring it back in that beauty. The beauty of engineering, by the way, that existed in the museum in the 19th century, and a lot of changes were made in the building, so we reconstruct the building. And at the same time, we will create a new institution, not another museum. It's not V&A Britain and V&A Modern. It's part of the, let's say, the DNA that always belonged to the V&A, and that's urbanism, architecture, engineering, design. Our collection, our storage facility will be in East London. Our research institute will be in East London. A think tank, like my colleagues call it. Meant by with a think tank and a think tank. And we will work with practitioners and public in a completely different way. And that's a great opportunity. The other one is the synergy. The UAL, the University of Arts London, will move with the Fashion College to the same area. We will have shared space, except also with the Sadler's Wells. There are a lot of new ideas that will be combined in the Olympic Park, and definitely a very close relationship to UCL, because they also move over there.
London is very much regarded as the forefront of design cities in the world. The Chinese design scene is very young and growing. Can they learn from London? Is there anything from London that we can transpose to China as principles? Or does the Chinese design scene have to grow organically on its own?
I think what London can give to China is this idea of being a very international environment. China has a long tradition in terms of making, in craftsmanship, and now in design, what is called design, because it's a relatively new concept in China. But I think what we can bring is really maybe a global perspective on design, so making it international, facilitating exchange and sharing of ideas and techniques. And I think we can both learn from each other in a very productive way. And I think in terms of the design scene in China now, there is a lot of investment in terms of education. I learned from Xu Ping from the Chinese Academy of Fine Arts that there are at the moment around 1,900 institutions in China developing programs on design. And there is also a very clear shift from the government, from the idea of making in China to this idea of creating in China, as Martin was also mentioning in his talk. And I think probably there will be also a new stage trying to combine a very long tradition of craftsmanship and making in China with something that is much more technologically advanced in the realm of digital, for example. And I think Shenzhen is one of the places where these new avenues are opening up.
For many people, the obvious choice to open such a large-scale museum and have V&A involvement in would be Beijing, Shanghai, which arguably surprised a lot of people when you chose Shenzhen, especially Shekou. What potential do you see in Shenzhen?
I was the first time in Shenzhen, I think it was in 1998, and it was a completely different city. I mean, the layout was already done for that city. There was so much traffic, and I mean, it was already a city that was different to a lot of other cities in China, as we know. So I think the master plan for that city is not only a master plan of architecture and mobility, it's also a master plan of the industries, the economy, and the design part of it is really eminent. I think that's the reason why we choose it. The other reason is very well known, I mean, since the 70s, for printing, designing, graphics, and so on. So that's the other reason. There is already knowledge, there's experience. So it's not going to no man's land of ideas and starting point zero. There is a need for it. And maybe most important, at least from my strategy, is that I personally like very much this Pearl River Delta with all those major hubs from Macau to Hong Kong to Guangzhou to Shenzhen. So that area is growing together with fast-going trains and everything. So the outreach of that museum could be amazing.
And this is the first foray into partnerships, especially in China. Is this the start of a new chapter for the V&A? Will we see future projects? Perhaps it's a bit too soon to say.
It's not so much a business case, it's more philosophy. And how we see our world, I think after all those political changes that we saw in the late 80s, early 90s, we answered those demands in sending objects around the world and exhibitions around the world. What we need today is our long-term strategies. And there is already an expertise, and it's, in my opinion, more sufficient, more inspiring, more creative, and we need something like joint platforms. That world of digital communication makes it not so important that we send objects around the world. It's more like showing it together and working on it together and doing research projects together.
Will we see V&A exhibitions being set up in Shekou, or will there be a local spin on things to help them build a collection that has international relevance as well?
Well, first of all, we are definitely sending exhibitions and objects. We are making a V&A gallery. But the underlying idea of having a V&A gallery there is not really to transplant a section of the museum into China, but really trying to develop a content that is very relevant to China and specifically to Shenzhen. So it is more a platform, an opportunity that we are creating in the physical form of a gallery, but in fact we are more interested in creating a dialogue with the local environment and creative communities. I really want to stress out that this is not a project through which we are sending a gallery or objects in a place, but everything will be done responding also to what is important and relevant locally and in China.
That was Monocle's Vivian Liu speaking to director of the V&A, Martin Roth, and head of V&A Shekou, Louisa Mengoni. And for our third and final instalment from Business of Design Week that took place in Hong Kong earlier this month, we speak to a designer and a businesswoman. British-Chinese designer Elaine Ung started her Hong Kong-based studio, The Fabric Lab, as a textile consultancy, working to create unconventional textile surfaces and materials. Over the past year, Elaine Ung has created materials that can physically adapt to changes in light, temperature, and humidity, while also researching endangered weaving traditions in China's Guizhou province to create fabric inspired by the region's cultural traditions. Monocle's Vivian Liu spoke to Elaine during Business of Design Week in Hong Kong to find out more about her practice.
The Fabric Lab is a material consultancy specialised in textiles and bespoke installations and sort of prototypes making. Or interactive materials can be built through Asian craft techniques as well as digital fabrications.
And you make some really beautiful smart fabrics, and in particular you work with a craftsman in Guizhou. Can you describe a little bit about what these fabrics look like?
So for the smart textile side, I'm specialised with shape memory alloy and polymers. So these are material that change shapes according to change of temperature or electrical impulses. So they could look like anything. And most of my smart materials, they are woven in Jacquard loom, as well as hand loom. And also some of them are embedded with wood, because I consider there shouldn't be a boundary for what textile is. And wood can also be one of the material considered as textiles. And the fabrics that's woven in Guizhou is rather special, actually, because we're not changing the techniques they're applying, but we're just shifting some material that's being used. For example, we have recycled polyester or recycled nylon that's really great for architectural use. So we're looking into how can we have cottage industry for like a really bespoke architectural applied textiles.
And how does being in Hong Kong and your Chinese heritage influence what you do, especially in terms of textile design?
That is a tricky question. Actually, being in Hong Kong, the best advantage of being in Hong Kong is as an international hub. And so I can really showcase this new material much easier to international crowd. But also it's easy for me to travel from one place to another. And a lot of time I need to travel quite a lot internationally. So, and I think I'm a good advantage for being in Hong Kong.
And this week, you're involved as part of Detour, PMQ, the Police Married Quarters, which is the new creative hub in Hong Kong. And you've set up a pop-up workshop. Can you tell us a little bit about the workshop and what you hope to achieve and bring to the Hong Kong creative scene?
Okay, that's two sides of it. So the unit that we're in, part of it, called it the Fabric Lab, the Material Playground. Really just want to showcase to people, the public, how material can be really playful. They can change according to UV, light absorbing. So that's as an introduction of what we do. So say hello to Hong Kong, we're here. Second part of the workshop is actually a demonstration of new community, let's say, trying to bring to Hong Kong, called Nature Tech. Nature Tech, it's sort of the meaning, same as the name. How can we bring technologies from nature to Hong Kong? Look into like the cleverness of it. And the very first series is called Biochromes. So learning from extracting colors from nature, what benefits can we get from it? How do we building from natural dyes to natural crystal paint and then to create a biodegradable substrate from the dye? So it's all about pushing boundaries. Don't jump conclusion from point A to point B, but really explore in between all the obstacles and build into your biodegradable palettes and your little toolbox.
The Hong Kong creative design scene is relatively young and perhaps underdeveloped compared to other cities. Do you think this is an advantage for you to showcase and introduce your work and your aesthetics to the people here?
I think definitely. I mean, there's actually a lot of very talented designers in Hong Kong. And a lot of public perceived things, Hong Kong is not as advanced as other countries because they don't have direct communications or they don't have shops, so it's not so accessible to them. So I think the detour actually is a very good opportunity for myself to showcase I'm only one of them and I can't represent all the designers in Hong Kong. So I think hopefully this can give the public a good glimpse what Hong Kong designer can offer.
That was Monocle's Vivian Liu speaking to Elaine Ung at the Business of Design Week that was held in Hong Kong earlier this month. This is Section D with me, David Pleasant, where we'll return after this short break.
Still looking for a Christmas shopping inspiration? Well, look no further. Monocle Films travelled to Antwerp to discover festive surprises. From custom-fitted gloves to juniper-infused spirits, Monocle Films has Christmas covered.
It might only have a population of 500,000, but Belgium's second city is our first choice for shopping this Yuletide. The unassuming Berg isn't one to brag, but has long been one of Europe's most prosperous ports and houses an enviable roster of independent retailers who have quietly grown to reflect the city's commercial potential.
Bring the Cheer, our film highlighting Antwerp's Christmas shopping solutions, now playing on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, design brands aren't ones to be shy when it comes to celebrating an important anniversary or a best-selling work from their portfolio. But sometimes a little subtlety can go a long way. Take Italy's Poro. In 2015, the fourth-generation family-run firm celebrates 90 years in business. To mark that milestone, the company decided to start the festivities a bit early and unveil its newest products for Christmas. But instead of unveiling a flashy piece of furniture at an extravagant launch party to grab headlines, the company decided to show a simple yet timeless toy, the spinning top. Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, visited the Poro showroom in Milan to learn more.
Started in 1925 in Brianza, the region north of Milan, long recognized as the birthplace of Italian furniture, Poro is an established player on the country's design scene. The company is a big proponent of Brianza's artisans, particularly those craftsmen skilled at working with wood. Poro's art director is architect Piero Lissoni, who is keen to tap into the area's traditional ways of working to make a very old-world toy, the spinning top.
Why is it possible to design a 2014 spin top? But I prefer to use the Italian name trottola because, you know, spin tops sounds immediately so scientific. Trottola, it's a little bit more poetic, and from the whole discussion, we use only the name, the original one in Italian, trottola. Well, can you imagine in our life, since I think more than 2,000 years, every children play with the trottolas. They used trottola every day, you know. It was a fantastic, fantastic, fantastic toy. A few years later, 2014, in the middle of a lot of devices and a lot of electronics and a lot of strange thoughts, we are decided to design a simple one to be back in a trottola way, in a trottola world. And the trottola world is unbelievably simple, but at the same time, you have to respect a lot of physical rules. Think about of Mr. Newton, gravity, think about of the spin, think about the vectorial speed. Well, it's a design. And we combine together many different thoughts. The simplicity, the special physical rules, and in the same time, the special human touch. We put inside a lot of different wood. We discover hands worker in Brianza, old people and young people, you know. We combine together many different technologies, simple one, but in the same time, historical technologies. And when I'm talking about of historical technology, I'm thinking, you know, in Italian we use a special name, ebanista. Ebanista is a special worker who combined together many different qualities of wood.
Wood is one of Poro's favorite materials. And in the five spinning tops the company has made, each mixes different kinds of wood, such as ash, walnut, and oak. By spinning them, Lissoni demonstrates the duration of each and the unique sound each makes.
I didn't design the shape. The physics rules, they design the shape. For example, one of them, she is very, very functional for make some evolutions, you know, to make some something like this. But another one, she is unbelievable, very, very good, because she becomes super, super precise and she spin for many, many minutes. Did you see?
One happy to have a go with these new toys is Maria Poro, who represents the fourth generation of the family business. She was looking for an object that could be both playful, but also show off in a clever way some of the brand's know-how.
It's very important to understand how to work with wood to create this kind of object. And also the fact that we decided to create a collection of spinning tops, so very small object, and Piero designed them with very thin surfaces. So we push the technique and we work with different kind of woods, combining them in order to create a small object, but with very nice details. The hand turn technique, it's a very antique technique used to produce like the legs of the chairs or small details. And you have to start from a piece of wood and to transform it into something else in a small object. So it's part of the know-how of our territory. So that's why we like to preserve this kind of technique, because we think that it's part of this world made in Italy that we absolutely want to preserve and to continue in our tradition.
That was Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Cavallo, visiting the Poro showroom. Nearly every artist, be it a designer or a musician, is likely to say what an important role their workplace plays in the creative process. This is certainly true of two young designers from Moscow who make handmade accessories for men. Both of them have chosen inspiring surroundings on the opposite ends of the Russian capital to be their studios, which they say help them better concentrate on their work. But these studios also reflect the two designers' very distinct styles. Our contributor in Moscow, Valentin Ognev, started by speaking to Mihail Prolov, who started his own brand, F22.
Mostly I make men's accessories, such as card holders, banknote holders, simple wallets. All these things made by myself in this studio in Elektrozavod.
Meet Mihail Prolov, the founder of the F22 brand that specializes in men's leather accessories. Mikhail has been in the business since 2010, and about a year ago he moved into this studio at the iconic electrical devices plant in eastern Moscow. The plant, called Elektrozavod in Russian, was built in 1914 and is still operating. But large parts of it are rented out to various artists, designers and craftsmen. Mikhail had been waiting for 3 years for the studio to become available.
All production is based in this studio, and all the products come out from this place. Almost everything what I do, it is made by me, by my own hands.
The fading sun shines through the large industrial window as Mikhail works on a new item. Previously, the studio was a chemical laboratory, and Mikhail used this heritage to create some very unique interior design. Here on the table, a bowl with fruit stands near a ray tube from an old TV set, all surrounded by Soviet era machines that Mikhail uses in his production. All these objects are simple, but the way Mikhail combines them is strikingly sophisticated. And that reflects in his work, he says.
The main idea of a brand that we made simple things, but not simplified. If I like what I do, I'm sure that somebody out there will like it too. It's easy.
Mihail tells me it's nice to have a place where you can just work without distractions. To relax, he either visits fellow artists next door or else takes a walk around the plant where he takes pictures with his film camera.
For me, inspiration is rather easy thing because every day I met some new people and lots of them trying to change the world around them. And that's one really inspirational because you understand that you can do everything.
Across town, in a 19th century lodging house, is the studio of Sergei Malyhin, where he makes bow ties, neckties and wool caps under the brand name Engineer Garin, a reference to a character from an early Soviet novel.
It's not about accessories, it's about a way of life. I'm trying to get across my point of view.
On the walls, there are photos from the 1920s and 30s picturing young men in fancy dress. It's a vast source of inspiration for Sergei.
I'm always looking for different pictures, different stories. I like taking walks. I like what I see around me.
Together with a seamstress, because Sergei himself can't sew, he can spend hours, sometimes days on end, in this tiny little room with its squeaky floorboards, inventing new ideas.
Can you feel how wonderful it is here when it is quiet like this? I was mesmerized by this ambience when I first came in here. In the evening, you can hear people talking as they pass by in the street. There's a whole life out there.
And if Sergei needs quiet to get into a working mood, Mikhail likes his studio at Elektrozavod to be filled with music. Lapsing into his native Russian, Mikhail introduces me to one track that he says keeps him inspired. The track is Gianti by Moki. For Monocle in Moscow, I am Valentin Ognev.
That was Valentin Ognev bringing that from the studios of accessories designer Mikhail Prolov. Still to come on the show, we revisit Design Miami and have a walk through two gallery spaces. And from there, we head north to Toronto for the IDEX National Design and Architecture Expo. As Design Miami reached its 10th anniversary this year, we thought we'd have a look at two of the showrooms that have been around since the beginning. Christina Grajales and Kim Holstler of Hostler Burrows were two of the founding galleries at the annual show. Our Megan Billings paid each of them a visit at Design Miami to talk about how the fair has evolved and how they keep their booths fresh from year to year.
My gallery is located in New York, and we have a very eclectic collection in our gallery. The designers that we work with, they come from many different parts of the world, from South America to Europe to North America. We have pieces that are very dynamic. One of the designers that we work with is Sebastian Errázuriz. He's a Chilean designer that really merges the lines between art and design. And some of the furniture that he makes really wants for the people that buy it to be engaged by the piece. So it makes you work a little bit. You have to open and close it. It creates all these different forms when you get close to the piece. We also have the work of Jorge Lizarazo from Hechizú. It's a Colombian textile company. We do commissions for clients all over the world, including Chanel, Dior, and Louis Vuitton. And everything is hand-woven, and it's one of the greatest satisfactions for me being Colombian and knowing that we began with the Chisú with 10 weavers, and now we have 60 weavers. So it's a very satisfactory moment in my life to know that we have developed the business so much in the past few years. We also have the work of Stefan Bishop, who's an American designer from Los Angeles. We just launched his work in Design Miami in the 10th edition of Design Miami. And the pieces are made out of bronze, so they're solid bronze. And he's inspired by water puddles. And another recent discovery that's very exciting for us is the work of the brothers William and Stephen Ladd from St. Louis. They've been collecting beads and trinkets since they are 15 years old. And they make these little boxes that in the beginning it was just on a surface, but recently we've taken these little boxes from the table to the wall. They have several museum exhibitions, including right now the Parish Museum in Watermill.
So you've been here since the beginning of Design Miami, and I'm just curious about when you're putting your booth together every year you come back, and how much thought has to go into making it different or special, or do you keep it the same? What kind of goes through your mind when you're building it?
You never keep it the same. That's part of the fun of participating in these fairs. We start planning our booth a couple of months in advance, and you also have to pay attention to your audience. There's a big difference between the audience in Miami and the audience in Basel or the audience in New York. So you always have to be aware of the place where the fair is taking place.
So when you come here for the audience in Miami, what exactly would you do differently?
Well, for instance, for Miami, we thought it would be nice to bring an Echisu rug that has beautiful colors. So it's very, you know, pastel, beautiful colors that are refreshing, that are tropical colors. So I didn't think it was a good idea to bring a black leather rug that felt a little heavy. So you have to think about those things.
I'm also thinking about when you're coming back to a fair year after year, how has the scene changed for Design Miami in Miami?
Being one of the founding galleries of Design Miami, it's been really wonderful to see the transformation of the fair from 2005 to what's happening now. In 2005, there were 15 of us. It was very exciting that first evening of the first Design Miami, but there were very few of us. And to see what's going on now, to see the crowds. Today, when I came into work, there was a line out the door for people that wanted to come in and see the show, including many kids. And I was told that some of these kids travel an hour and a half to come and see the exhibition. To me, that's incredible. It's a great success story that so many people want to come and see what we're doing, and also to see the variety of the galleries.
And speaking of the other galleries, I also want to know, what is the relationship that you have then to the other galleries that you see year after year? Is it a bit like summer camp, you're coming back and seeing each other?
It's like a family. You know, it's really fun to see our friends. We know each other for so many years. It's very much the same people. And it's a wonderful, wonderful, it's really exciting to see your friends. You know that you're going to see them every year in Basel and Miami. So it is like summer camp.
My name is Kim Hostler from the Hostler Burroughs Gallery in New York. We specialize in mid-20th century Scandinavian furniture and decorative arts with a strong focus on ceramic work. We've recently added contemporary ceramics to our program, and it's the first time we've offered contemporary ceramics at Design Miami. We have three artists we're working with here.
I'd like to get a sense, since you're one of the founding showrooms, how has the scene really changed here in the 10 years that you've been here?
Well, the scene's gotten a lot bigger, a lot more developed. It's a little more famous. It used to be kind of underground. When we first started showing modern things, people thought we were insane, and we were really seen and treated as used furniture dealers. The things people didn't want, I found that on the side of the curb kind of attitude. And now it's a lot edgier, it's a lot more mainstream. Of course, you're seeing modern design everywhere, so we have to work a little bit harder to bring new things to the public.
So when you're kind of thinking about coming back to Design Miami every year, how much thought goes into diversifying or trying to make your booth extra attractive?
Right, that's a good question. And that's a good question because the Design Miami crowd is an international crowd. It's a well-traveled group of collectors and interested people that know what's going on. So you can't sort of get by on just showing something regular, or we can't just be from New York. You really have to bring the show and think about what you're doing. I don't diversify too much. I try to stay in my program. We like to know what we're doing and be good at it. This isn't a place where I really come to explore or try new markets. Even though we are bringing new works and new artists that we're showing, they're artists that are sort of tried and true. For us, this isn't an exploratory expedition.
And in terms of Design Miami in Miami versus in Basel, what's the difference there in terms of the crowd or the fellow dealers?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the obvious things. Basel, you're in Europe and you have a strong European crowd who I think has a stronger connection to the past. You know, they're rooted in the mid-20th century, World War II. I mean, it had a profound effect on most people, on their families, and they have a personal connection to that. And maybe a more sentimental and caring feeling about the past. And of course, Miami is closer to Central America and South America. So you have a stronger, you know, Latin feel, and we're in the warm weather. So the feeling is lighter and brighter, but you get people from all over the world here. We've sold things to Europe, and we always sell things to New York, which is funny because we come from New York and we travel a long way from home just to run into regular clients and sell them something else that goes back to New York. But that's all part of it.
I'm also really curious about when a gallery or a showroom comes to Design Miami, how much of being here is about selling and how much of being here is just kind of about having a presence and showing your brand?
I think that really depends on the individual gallery and what their history is, what their goals are, what their financial, you know, ability is. Some galleries are funded or backed. Some galleries are, just barely just making it, right? I don't know. For us, it's important to sell. We're a small gallery. It's important for us to be here for all the reasons that you mentioned. It's a good place for us to see how we're doing. You know, we get feedback. I like to talk to people. We're picking the things out ourselves. We own our material, and I'm reselling it. It's really basic. So if I go to a fair and I don't sell anything, I don't think I did a good job choosing or putting my program together. So in addition to just the basic finances of making money and paying bills, it also validates the choices I'm making in the program and how Juliet and I are doing with the business in general.
That was Monocle's Megan Billings taking a tour of gallery spaces of Christina Grajales and Kim Holsler at Design Miami, which took place at the beginning of December.
It's the art of publishing with skates on. Here it comes, Monocle Alpino. Here's what some of our Wrapped Up for the Elements editors have for you this winter.
In the affairs section, we take to the slopes with a Swiss scientist trying to predict when avalanches strike.
In the business section, we visit Slovenia to see how one ski company has been making its precious pieces since 1945.
In culture, we head to the Arctic Circle to find out how Norwegians do music festivals. Needless to say, they do them cooler than most.
Monocle Alpino is on newsstands now. For more information and Monocle subscriptions, head to monocle.com.
This is Monocle 24, and you're listening to Section D. Now, in its 13th year, IDEX is a multidisciplinary national design and architecture expo that was recently held in Toronto. From lighting to healthcare to landscape and retail, the bustling two-day event challenges participants to rethink commercial space through a variety of workshops, seminars, and keynote addresses. Sophia Lepage from our Toronto Bureau had the chance to see the show, featuring over 350 exhibitors from every corner of the design community. She met with IDEX Vice President Tracy Bowie.
IDEX Canada is Canada's national trade show and conference for interior designers, architects, builders, developers. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year and moving home to the Metro Toronto Convention Centre, the North Building, where IDEX started in 1984. And actually, we were one of the first shows in the MTCC. You said that IDEXX is in your 30th year. Is there something in particular you're celebrating? Progress or landmarks or... Well, actually, I've been at every show except for the first one. So since 1985, and I've been working on IDEXX for 18 years. And I think there's just such a transformation with the impact of technology on design. And so I don't think you can even compare what happened in 1984 to what happens in 2014. But as we walk around the show, I think there's so many interesting materials and innovations and creativity and use of products and applications, that it's just almost overwhelming.
Is there any exhibitors that you're particularly excited to see this year?
Well, I think we always have had great support from Canadian manufacturers as well as really key U.S. and international manufacturers that are kind of our core group of exhibitors. And they continue to support us to this day. But we have something we call our partners. And we have 9 partners at the show. And they're our largest exhibitors. They work with us all year on promoting the show. They showcase new products, that we have their logo on everything. And I think they have the largest booth at the show. So I think the partners that we have, Richelieu, Levy, Metro, Gispen, Philips, Ultra, Shaw, Tandis, Centiva, Tarquet, they're all internationally leading companies, and they're really showing some great innovative products this year. And Interface, Floor, and Richelieu, I missed too.
So what is the significance of holding this event in Toronto versus other Canadian cities?
I think that you need a large enough market to support a large trade show. And so we have international buyers, we have Canadian designers and architects from across the country attending the show. But Toronto is the financial center of Canada. That's where a lot of the majority of business comes from Canada. Toronto is the 4th largest market in North America. We have the 3rd largest design workforce in North America. So there is such a hub and nucleus of design in Toronto and business. So combined with all of the international, the Canadian, and then the Toronto market attending the show, it makes for a very successful show.
So the website for IDEXX says it celebrates creativity and best practices. I was wondering if the criteria for best practices changes every year, and if so, what are the best practices you think for this year?
I think best practices, you know, is kind of a difficult thing to define, but I think it's best practices in design and building and products. And so I think what we're dealing with here is a very sophisticated market with very sophisticated, not only consumers of products, but also a very sophisticated design market. So some of the things that we're introducing at IDEXX, certainly with our conference program, are not necessarily sexy products. I mean, there is new disability standards coming out in 2015 called AODA standards in Ontario. And so we have a lot of seminars on building code, on the new barrier-free standards. But it's very, very important, and it impacts everyone's daily lives, and it shows the impact that design and designers can have on everyone's daily lives. So it's not just about fluffing pillows, it's about the way you feel. And so health and wellness is so crucial in our market right now. So, you know, we have beautiful hospitals with natural sunlight and beautiful colors. And so, you know, the stats are that people heal faster when you're in that kind of environment. And it's how that can impact.
Do you think that the general public understands that design can really interact with a public space like a hospital? Or is it something that designers typically want, like design is invisible?
There's kind of 2 different types of general public. I think there's homeowners as the general public. And with the IDEXX show having all areas of design, so all areas of design would be for healthcare, for hospitality, for workplace, for high-end residential, healthcare, retail, etc. So our consumers are different than a homeowner. Our consumers would be probably a bit more sophisticated and understand the impact that design can have on a space, and they would have a lot of research to support that. So the manufacturers would, the designers would, the architects would. So it's all about the lighting, the materials, the products, you know, the wayfinding, everything impacts. And I think one thing that I think has changed over the 30 years that I've been involved in IDEX and the design and architecture business is that all of the design disciplines are working together now. So when there's a big hospital project, everyone is at the table. And so designers and architects with the builder and developer and the lighting designer and the landscape architect. So you can't have this wonderful building and forget about the interior and the exterior and the technology and the innovation and everything that needs to go into the space. And I think that's what's really exciting right now.
Speaking about the evolution from the beginning of IDEX to now, how big of a part do you think has sustainable design and architecture played into the thought process of the designers and architects exhibited here?
We actually started in about 2001 having a sustainable design area in the show, and that was when LEED and US Green Building Council was sort of just underway. And I think the exciting part now is that we don't have a green or sustainable part of the show any longer because everyone is doing it. So clients are demanding it. Designers and architects all have their certification, and the manufacturers are all doing the right thing. But it was baby steps. It was an evolution, and the idea was to have market transformation. And the exciting thing is that the market has transformed, and sustainable design is now mainstream. But what's exciting is that we actually have some great seminars at IDEX on design and real estate, and I think health and wellness is the next stage of kind of, if you want to call it, sustainability or market transformation that we're working toward.
Speaking a bit about Canadian design, people often refer to Japanese design or Nordic design. Do you think there's a Canadian design identity, or is it more multiplicity in the design that reflects our nation that's like more appropriate for Canada?
Well, I don't think Canadian design is just something with a maple leaf in it. So we did see some great products on the show floor that were made using wood. And wood is certainly a product that we have a lot of in Canada. And so there's some amazing uses of wood in Canadian design. You know, Canadian designers, well, and all designers, I mean, they're traveling around the world. They're visiting places. They're being educated by people that have traveled and been educated around the world. So I think we have some of the best, most creative, most qualified designers in the world, both practicing designers and manufacturers as well. And I think that Canada is a bit of a hidden resource on the world stage, and I think we're ready to explode. We have great design, we have great creativity, we have great quality, and, you know, the sky's the limit.
That was Sophia Lepage bringing us that report from Toronto's IDEX Design and Architecture Expo. And that's all we've got time for on Section D today. Please email me at dmp@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or have any comments or queries. I'm David Pleasant, and to play us out, and going back to Hong Kong, where we heard from at the beginning of the show, we have My Little Airport with Who Invented Work. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.